A 70-year-old neurosurgeon volunteers for a brain scan out of curiosity and vanity. Months later, viewing the results, he confronts an image that devastates him more than any diagnosis could. His brain appears shrunken and withered, riddled with white spots indicating ischemic damage. He's staring at his own decay, death foretold in clinical images. For 4 decades, Henry Marsh inhabited medicine's world, witnessing fear, suffering, and death without truly considering what it would feel like when his turn came. 20 months after this confrontation with mortality through imaging, a prostate cancer diagnosis shatters the deep-seated denial that protected him throughout his career. What he'd considered stoicism was actually fear. The symbolic skull he'd kept in his study for years, a memento mori imitating Dürer's famous painting, suddenly becomes too painfully concrete. He gives it away. The abstract reminder of death has become unbearably real, transforming him from observer to participant in mortality's inevitable dance. The brain contains 86 billion neurons, 125 trillion synapses, and 500,000 kilometers of wiring. From this cellular network emerges thought, feeling, and consciousness, yet science cannot explain how. Throughout history, we've understood the brain through contemporary technology. Descartes saw hydraulics, the 19th century saw telephone exchanges, Freud saw hydraulic repression. Today, we see computers. All metaphors fail. Struggling to wake each morning, Marsh imagines his conscious self as a submarine surfacing from deep ocean, deluding himself he's steering when actually moved by currents. But even this fails. His conscious and unconscious selves aren't separate entities, but the same neurons. Watching his granddaughters learn effortlessly, he envies their neuroplasticity while struggling with math lessons, a poignant reminder that his brain physically shrinks with age. The COVID-19 lockdown brought an otherworldly experience. Perfect spring weather, silent streets, clear skies filled with stars and birdsong, creating both sanctuary and profound loss. Looking at his home and garden, Marsh felt mortality's weight, knowing he would eventually leave it all behind. The unnaturally fine weather reminded him that nature was out of joint, foreshadowing worse to come. In retirement, memories of former patients began appearing unexpectedly. An Ecuadorian botanist with an incurable brain tumor sent photographs of his beloved rainforest before dying. After his cancer diagnosis, even more patient memories surfaced, some from 30 years prior, becoming reproachful ghosts. He realized how many patients must have felt anxious and abandoned, feelings he'd often overlooked. True empathy would make the work impossible. You'd feel everything your patients felt. Instead, you practice limited compassion without losing humanity. The simplest way to limit empathy is dividing people into us and them. As a medical student, he'd been distressed watching patients demonstrated like specimens, particularly a young ex-soldier with an inoperable spinal tumor. After his diagnosis, he dreamed of reconciling with their old family dog he'd once tormented, both now old, with bladder problems, approaching death. Hospitals are fundamentally disempowering places that emphasize the gap between staff and patients. The word hospital derives from Latin hospes, meaning guest, originally charitable refuges where religious services mattered as much as medical treatment. Marsh's old workplace was built on human scale, 3 stories high with fewer than 200 staff he knew personally, creating tribal connection and efficiency. When they moved to a massive new building, that intimacy vanished. Throughout his career, he fought to improve sterile environments by creating healing gardens on forbidden balconies and installing landscape photographs. Most hospitals remain horrible because enhancements aren't planned from the beginning, and patients are treated as an underclass despite notices claiming dignity and respect. This understanding became painfully personal when Marsh entered the Royal Marsden Cancer Hospital as a patient. The corridors were typical, bright, windowless passages with pathetic art and admonitory notices. Yet, he found unexpected beauty in the scanning department skylight looking out onto rain-slicked roofs, a pleasantly philosophical waiting experience despite being surrounded by patients ravaged by chemotherapy. Despite years of symptoms, Marsh postponed seeing a doctor until after lockdown. His PSA returned at 127. Most cancer cases are below 20. Internet searches suggested men with such levels typically die within years. At the Marsden, his oncologist opened ominously, "Let me start by saying how sorry I am that we are meeting like this." He estimated a 70% probability the cancer had spread. When Marsh suggested cycling might have elevated his PSA, the doctor dismissed it. "You would have to bicycle 100 miles on a very bumpy road to raise it by maybe one." Marsh struggled with his dual role, asking to be spoken to as a colleague while simultaneously craving reassurance. Asked about 5-year survival, the doctor avoided percentages. "You needn't write your will for 5 years," joking that Marsh could complete 5 more books. When the consultation ended, Marsh glimpsed the oncologist laughing with colleagues through an open door, while a nurse dismissed him. "You can go." He had crossed to the other side, just another old man with prostate cancer. Prostate cancer typically spreads to bones, causing severe pain and potential paralysis. Modern medicine has prolonged dying, often in hospitals among strangers with little dignity. After his diagnosis, Marsh became desperate, imagining his potential death. He has a suicide kit, but worried it might fail, so he asked a doctor friend to help him when needed. As a doctor, he has access to an easier death than UK law permits. Despite 80% public support, assisted dying legislation was defeated in Parliament in 2015. Opponents argue it would pressure vulnerable people into suicide, a claim unsupported by evidence from countries where it's legal. If patients can choose pain-killing treatment that might hasten death, why can't they choose treatment that brings death swiftly? Marsh finds it illogical that religious opponents, who believe in an afterlife, oppose hastening the journey there. The claim that dying is transcendent seems distasteful. Any transcendence is more likely experienced by witnesses than the dying. Our fear of death makes it difficult to see dying as a practical problem with legal solutions. Helping someone to a peaceful, chosen death is an act of care and love. 6 months post-radiotherapy, Marsh's PSA levels dropped to 0.1, though he knew recurrence probability remained 75% within 5 years. 10 days later, Putin's invasion of Ukraine eclipsed his cancer anxiety. After 3 decades training Ukrainian surgeons, daily calls punctuated by air raid sirens evoked his mother's World War II stories. His colleagues' resilience amid devastation strengthened his resolve to continue working there, an act of resistance against both war and mortality. Whether crafting dollhouses for his granddaughters or mentoring young neurosurgeons, Marsh demonstrates that purpose flourishes in mortality's shadow. True legacy lies not in operations performed or accolades received, but in ripple effects. The stories shared, wisdom passed on, love invested in others. These elements survive us, living on in those we've touched. Embracing our mortality might be the key to living more fully in whatever time remains.